seated.
My favorite early morning children's sermon participants have now proceeded to the next level of acolyte life. So we have to talk later, Braden, if we, you know, if you've become too mature for children's sermons or if you're still into it. Meh, he says, okay. Well, then I'm going to just preach, okay? You're going to have to pay attention to this one, yeah. This week, as I was thinking about our gospel today, I realized that when I imagine this story, I have a very definite scenario in my brain. For some reason, for quite some time, I have imagined that Jesus and the disciples were sitting at little tables outside. They're probably black wrought iron tables. You know the ones, the little two-top ones. They're having a beverage, maybe a glass of beer or little cups of very dark coffee, and they're people watching, as people will do in the spring when it's finally warm enough to sit outside and to enjoy the scenery. In truth, my imaginary backdrop looks a lot like some European bistro in a 1950s movie, something out of American in Paris or maybe Roman Holiday. You can just see it now. They're sitting there having their little cups of coffee, and they're watching the people, and the disciples are seeing folks come and go while Jesus gives a running commentary. Do you see those guys? Yeah, the ones in the robes. They stroll around hoping that someone will notice them, but watch out for them. They are not what they seem. They talk a good line. They make donations to all the best charities, but all they really want is for you to notice them because that's what they're really all about. They always take the best seat at a dinner party. They sit in the front row and worship so that people will be impressed with how holy they are. They are all about public perception. They want to appear faithful and compassionate, but really they're only concerned about themselves. Their charity is about making a good impression, not about caring for people in need. As they started on their second or third espresso, a solid stream of people seemed to be coming up and tossing money into the offering box, and people were tossing in quite a bit of money. And then she came by, quietly dropping her two pennies into the pot before disappearing into the crowd. "Did you see her?" Jesus said. "We've seen a lot of people giving today, but for the most part, it came from their surplus, from what was left after they paid themselves. But she in her poverty gave more than all the rest of them. Comparatively speaking, she made the biggest gift. She made the biggest sacrifice." Now, a lot of times when Jesus has these kinds of conversations with the disciples, he then tells them what they should do and how to do it. He turns the event into a teachable moment. But in this story, Jesus never says, "See what that woman did? Go and do likewise." He never says, "That's the example. Follow her example." He just points it out for us to notice. People often read the story as if Jesus ended it that way by saying, "You need to go and do just like she did." But he didn't. And so there is a temptation to read this story with one of two takes and to try and figure out where it is that I fit into the story. Am I one of those wealthy guys in the long robes? I have on my long robe. Am I looking for attention in worship? Am I one of those people who always thinks that they should sit at the head of the table? Do I need to be reminded that I live a life of privilege? Am I giving with a generous heart? Is my giving truly sacrificial? I'm pretty sure I've never had the life of the widow in our story. So does that mean then that my giving isn't sacrificial? Once upon a time, the word sacrifice meant to make something sacred. It's made of the word sacred and make. So a sacrifice was something that you valued, something that you gave, and in giving it, it became holy. The giving made it holy. A sacrifice was seen as an act of devotion or worship. But today the word has taken on a different meaning in slight, not that it means that this is a holy kind of gift, but rather this is a gift that we maybe don't have enough to really carry out. Or maybe it's more than we should give. And we think of sacrificial giving as a kind of giving that ought to hurt. And the more it hurts, the better you've done. It's supposed to go beyond people's expectations. So if our giving doesn't hurt, does that mean it isn't holy? It's easy to criticize the snooty religious practices that Jesus describes, and it is just as easy to lift up the widow as being a shining example of faithfulness. And as a result, we make one group the poster children for sin and the other a candidate for sainthood. It's as if the gospel is asking you, pick which group you want to belong to. Which one do you want to be? Do you want to be A or B, odd or even, up or down? Who do you want to be? Good church people usually would say, oh, I want to be choice B. I want to be like the sacrificial widow. That's the way I want to go. But I think that we choose that one because there isn't a third option. We're always kind of hoping for a third option. We put the widow on this neat little pedestal, but do we really want to be up there with her? At times, it seems that sacrifice is best when we can keep it at a distance. It's best when someone else is doing it. Somebody like Mother Teresa or Saint Francis or missionaries who go to impoverished countries far, far away or teachers who choose to teach in the poorest, toughest inner city neighborhoods knowing that they're putting more on a line than just a paycheck. We don't mind those kind of sacrifices because they're not ours and they're off at a distance and we can support them in some kind of way. We may examine their giving and see it as being far greater than our own. But does anything in our lives ever change? Do we really want to do what they're doing? Can we even imagine ourselves giving in that way? Theologian Emily Towns came up with a third option. And she said that instead of seeing ourselves as the rich or one of the poor, that maybe it would be wiser to see ourselves as the two coins. Towns says that those two little coins represent more than money. They represent faith and belief and how those things must be lived out in concrete acts and not just in religious rituals. She says, what if the coins represent faith-filled offering found in presenting all of who we are and all we hope to become to God for service to the world? Offering in this sense, Towns concludes, is something other than prayer or tithes or Eucharist or communion. It is not so much the act of giving or receiving as it is the act of being. Gregory of Nazianzus, who was a 4th century archbishop, put it like this, let us carry our first fruits to him who has suffered and risen for us. Do you think perhaps that I am talking of gold and silver, garments or precious stones? Insubstantial earthly goods, transitory, they're tied to earth. No, let us offer ourselves. It is the most precious and dearest gift in the eyes of God. Give to God's image what resembles it most. Give all, offer all to him who has given himself for us. Both Towns and Gregory call us to give our whole selves as an offering of God, everything that we are to God. And Jesus calls us to do the same. But can we do it? Do we dare? It sounds scary, really, if you start to think about it. Recently, I had a wonderful conversation with a woman, and we were talking about our background and where we were from, and she grew up in Cambodia. And I told her I remembered seeing on the news when I was a kid, seeing all of the footage of the people in Cambodia and what was happening to them and the war that went on in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, and that was a part of every evening, these horrible pictures of this war and what was going on. We talked about the Khmer Rouge and about the killing fields. All we had to say was those words, and there was a whole picture in my head, black and white or in color, just, you know, these terrible, terrible things that happened to her country. Now, I thought the war had ended when the Khmer Rouge was no longer in power. In my mind, the difficulties ended in, like, the early 70s. But as we talked, I realized that the suffering in that country continued with the Vietnamese occupation, and it lasted until 1992. She told me about her childhood. She comes from a family of teachers, and during the occupation, it was better to lie than to say that you had an education, because if you knew anything, if you had any knowledge, you were seen as dangerous and you could lose your life. And so her father and her relatives all, when the inspectors would come around to village and ask if they could read, if they knew anything, they would lie. Better not to be a teacher. And so that was the way they lived, in fear that someone would come and find out what they were doing. She remembered seeing piles of bones, of human bones, which would be made as big piles, a huge display, and they would move the display from place to place as a reminder to people of what happens when you step out of line. She said you could see all the bones. They were all dried. She said, but the smell goes on for a very long time. She told me about receiving school kits from UNICEF. Have you guys ever made school kits here at church? Lots of times the women of the ELCA group makes them. And she said you couldn't choose which backpack you got, but when you opened it, it was full of all of these wonderful things. Everything was in it, and it was new, and it was yours, and you got to keep it. So many good things, she said. I told her that my church was a part of those kinds of offerings. And as we smiled at one another, I knew how important those school kits had been to her. And rather than it being embarrassing or anything like that, it was this wonderful thing that we shared, that the giving had been blessed and the receiving had been welcome. She left Cambodia after her second year of college. She was going to be a teacher, but then she got an opportunity to come to the United States. You come to a new country, she said, the hardest thing to learn is the language. But she studied, and she took her GED, and she passed, and she has a job that she can do, and that she can do well. And I asked her if she thinks she will move back to Cambodia someday, and she said, oh, yes. She said, when I retire, then I am going to go back, and I'm going to become a teacher, and I'm going to start a school, and it's going to be free. You won't have to pay to come to this school. It will be a shelter for people who are poor, who need to learn, and they need to have knowledge, and that's what I'm going to do. I admire her for her bravery. She took a big risk to come to the United States, and I can't help but think that there will be risks and even dangers when she goes home. But this is what she has chosen to do with her life, not as a painful or frightening sacrifice, but as a holy gift. I don't know if she sees it that way, but for me, it was, when we were talking about it, just a sense of the holy and the sacred, and that she is offering all that she has in service to other people. Even today, this vision is long out, but that's what she's working towards. So what is the offering that we can make of our lives? Are we willing to take a few risks in order to give of ourselves more fully? Are we willing to take big risks to say, yeah, I'm not the guy in the robes or the woman with the mic. I'm just the two little coins that God's going to use. How would you live if you weren't afraid of what might happen next? One of the toughest fears for us to combat is the idea of scarcity. We worry that if we don't, you know, store things up and we don't save things, that the world is going to run out and there won't be enough for us and we won't get our share. There is a very old story rabbis will tell of the idea is that God made the world, and God made the world with just enough for everyone to live happily. No extras, no less. But if one person takes more than their share, what that means is that somebody else is going to get less. And so it's a way of being mindful of what we take in and what we keep and what we share. But we tend not to see the world that way. We either see it as being, you know, never ending in its blessings, or we see it as this competitive place where we have to try really hard. The fear works at you, and there's a temptation to hold on to more money and more stuff. But think about, for just a second, the widow of Zarephath. She is one of the sassier just sharp kind of women, I think, in the Bible. It comes off sometimes that she's very kind and sweet, but really, she's frightened of what's going to happen, and she dares to trust in a God that is not her own. This man that she doesn't know, who's been out, you know, just lying about in the middle of nowhere, clearly a stranger, no relation to her, says, "Hey, lady, will you get me a drink of water?" I got to think the widow rolled her eyes. Gets the drink of water, brings it back. And then he says, "Oh, what are you going to do now?" And she says, "Look, mister, I'm going to get enough sticks together to boil some water, to heat this up, to make a little pancake for my son. We're going to eat this food, and then we're dying. That's it for us." "Well, go do that. But first, make me a little pancake. Bring it back in your hand to me." And she says, "Yes." And he promises her that there will be enough. There will be enough. Not a lot, not too much, just enough. To trust in God that there will be enough. And so she gives, not just a pancake, not just a little loaf of bread. She offers to him her entire life in that moment, because she was going to eat that bread and die. She was going to feed her baby and then wait for what would come next. But she gives it all, her whole life, her son's safety, to this unknown stranger who says, "Trust in God. Step out and see if I don't catch you," God says. Try me. I will hold you up. We are the two little pennies. Not worth much, maybe, but worth enough. What will we do with our lives? The offering of that money was more than just an offering. It was giving of that woman's whole self. What are we willing to give? How can we learn to trust in God? For me, it's repeating the same things over and over and over again. Being reminded again and again and again, and having people around who remind me again and again, so that when I get scared, there is a community that I can go to say, "I'm not sure this is going to work." And they can say, "Look, here is God at work. Don't be afraid. Step out. See if God won't catch you. See if there won't be just a little bit more that's just enough to get you through the next day." That's why we come here, to get a little more, to get enough, so that we can go out again and serve our world, our community, and our family, because we've been fed by God's Spirit, and there will always be enough of that to go around.